The Sacramento Police Department asked for new rules for public protests. The city council didn't decide last night. On Inside, Cap Radio editor Nick Miller joins me to talk more about what's being proposed and the two very big headlines for the city this week, Ron Burkle investing in Major League Soccer and the rail yards heading for development. I talked with Mayor Daryl Steinberg yesterday afternoon about both. You'll hear more details from him. Kamala Harris is introducing herself to people across the country as a candidate for president. PolitiFact California and NationalPolitiFact.com will closely follow and fact-check her campaign. More about that. And later, Stories on Stage Sacramento starts its 10th season this Friday. In our studio today, Shelley Blanton Stroud with a new anthology titled This Side of the Divide, Stories of the American West. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Major League Soccer in Sacramento has Ron Burkle. The rail yards have Kaiser. These are two very big stories for the capital city this week. I talked briefly with Mayor Daryl Steinberg yesterday. At this moment, he's on his way to Washington, D.C. for the U.S. Council of Mayors. You're going to hear some of the conversation. Last night, he and the city council expected to take up a proposal from the Sacramento Police Department. This was about changing rules about what can and can't be carried at a public protest. And that's a good segue into Cap Radio's senior editor, Nick Miller, because there's a bit more to that story before we have any decision. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Glad to have you here. So the council planned to take it up. In fact, I talked to the mayor yesterday afternoon about it, and then something changed.
You did. At the 11th hour, they sort of pulled it from the agenda. And I'm talking at about 4:30 in the afternoon, and the council meeting begins at 5. And the city manager, Howard Chan, explained that they received significant feedback and questions from the public. There were concerns, of course, for instance, from the religious Sikh community about whether they could bring their ceremonial knives if they were going to go to a protest, because the proposed ordinance bans all knives, which, you know, the city says is sort of a common sense precaution. We don't want people with knives at demonstrations. You know, that could be dangerous. But then there were also concerns about free speech, about demonstrators feeling like they were being targeted. So they punted. They kicked it back to a committee, and they're going to take it up again in early February.
The list of what would now be prohibited under this ordinance is pretty detailed and lengthy. Some of these items were there before, but just here's the short version. Lumber, wood that is 1/4 inch or less in thickness and 2 inches or less in width, any length of metal or plastic pipe, baseballs, bats, aerosol sprays, tear gas, projectile launchers, balloons, bottles, open flame torches, shields, bricks, rocks, asphalt. I mean, it really goes on and on. But if you look at some of the video from protests in the capital city, in particular over the last 2 years, there are some really bloody, violent scenes.
Absolutely. I think many of your listeners have seen those images from Berkeley in the Bay Area during the protests between Antifa radicals and white nationalists. We saw swords. We saw bats that said, you know, beat up Nazis. We saw people with shields. We saw them launching explosive firework-type devices at buildings on the UC Berkeley campus. So these are the sort of videos and the images that law enforcement here in Sacramento are viewing and are responding to when they craft this type of ordinance. You know, the demonstrators, individuals with Black Lives Matter, converged on City Hall last night. They obviously didn't get the word in time that it was not going to be discussed. And when there was the opportunity to address it, the mayor actually had to leave the meeting and left. And people rushed to the front of the podium and were yelling and were upset, and they adjourned the meeting early. But this is going to be to be continued.
Where was Black Lives Matter on the concept of keeping protests safer and yet still allowing people the public demonstration, which is often emotional and sometimes volatile?
So it's really interesting. The conversations that I had with Black Lives Matter is that they need some of these items, the shields, the bats, the lumber, to protect themselves from white nationalists. And I think that directly speaks to the incident at the Capitol Park protest, where individuals were stabbed in Capitol Park in front of the state capitol a few years ago. and just sort of these other incidents that we've seen in Berkeley where these protests have gotten violent and the individuals on both sides argue that they need, you know, some sort of protection from each other.
I think I should clarify this. I think I said it backwards, Nick, but lumber, and often you see 2x4s being swung at the protests, at protesters. Any length of lumber or wood is being banned unless it's a 1/4 inch or less in thickness and 2 inches or less in width. So really, they are wiping out anything that can be used to swing or hit or be a weapon or a defensible piece of, I don't know, wood, stick of any type.
That's right. If you have a piece of wood that's too big, no good. But if you have a small enough piece to hold a sign, say at a women's march, that's okay.
And that's the important distinction there, isn't it? The police department issues seem to be coming before the Sacramento City Council more than ever in the last year, or maybe just in a more visible way. You've attended those meetings for years and years. What's your take?
I think this is a direct response to the actions and the demonstrations we had during Stephon Clark, but also just the contentiousness between some of those activist groups and the council members that we're seeing inside the City Hall chambers on Tuesday nights. If you'll recall, there was a similar ordinance proposed about decorum and behavior and how often and how or why we can eject people from council meetings that also got punted from the agenda at the 11th hour and has yet to be revisited. So there seems to be this pattern now, or at least it's occurred twice, where we're floating these contentious, controversial ordinances, seeing how they play out in the media, seeing what the conversation is like among activists on social media platforms. And then they get sort of pulled, and we'll see if it's going to be revisited. It's scheduled to be revisited February 5th in committee, so we'll see how it goes.
So let's listen to the conversation I had with the mayor yesterday, because I started on this, and again, this was recorded in the afternoon. He believed it was going to be on the agenda that night, did not have a clear indication of which way it might go, knew there was some opposition to it. So here's the mayor talking about the proposed ordinance.
The police department, the chief, came to me and asked for some, I think, very modest common sense changes to the law that ensure that the public is protected. And look at first and foremost, not only do I think protests are okay, I encourage them. This is the most important form of civic discourse and people exercising their constitutional rights. And I have no issue with people protesting, taking to the streets in peaceful ways. The ordinance simply says that you can't bring hard steel pipes or bats or things that could be used as weapons. And I think that's fair, and I think it's common sense.
It's quite a detailed list of items. Does that say something about how protests have changed in our city recently?
Well, actually, you know, even though there were some days of last year where I was worried about public safety, I actually am deeply appreciative of the way our community responded to some horrific events last March, the Stephon Clark shooting, and how largely peaceful the protests were. There were some exceptions. But I think this is a reasonable request. It's common sense. And I think it will assure people that they can participate, by the way, actively, vociferously in protests, but also remain safe.
Let me shift gears a bit, Mayor Steinberg, and give you two words. Ron Burkle. This is a name we've heard in Sacramento before.
My two words are woo-hoo. I am just over the moon. I am so happy today on behalf of Sacramento. You know, last year, in December of 2017, we went back to New York City and made our pitch for Major League Soccer. And it was a great proposal, a passionate fan base, great stadium plan. The league said, we need you to bring in a partner or partners that will help provide more capital for the effort. And they gave us essentially a punch list. And we spent 2018 working quietly, but working very hard. And we are partnering with Ron Burkle, who is great success in every walk of life who believes in Sacramento. I've known Ron for a number of years. And we are prepared to go back again to New York City, having met that punch list that the commissioner of the league put out. And I am very hopeful that we are going to win. We should win. And now we have met all the tests. So a great day for Sacramento, not only the big Kaiser announcement for the rail yards, but we are on the doorstep of getting a Major League Soccer franchise. And what it also means for the overall development of the rail yards cannot be overstated, because not only has Ron Burkle bought the team and the stadium site, but also the 14 acres east of 7th Street, which is going to be Sacramento's next destination district. And it really means that with the Kellys, who have really hung in there with the city for a long time and done a great job, that we have a chance now to catalyze this great extension of downtown in a way that will have tremendous benefit economically, job-wise, housing, affordable housing, for many decades to come.
Can I go back in history a bit on Ron Burkle? Can you tell me what your understanding is about why he dropped out of being part of the effort to keep the Sacramento Kings? Because when I said we'd heard his name here before, that's the history I was referring to about 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, Ron was interested in buying the Sacramento Kings during that 2013 chapter when we were fighting to save the Kings from moving to Seattle. And he would have bought the Kings. The issue, I think, arose because he owns a sports management agency. And for whatever reason, the league considered owning a team and representing players in any sport to be a potential conflict. So Ron wasn't able to participate there. But I know that the relationships that were developed at the time and his feel for Sacramento was nothing but positive. And so, you know, one door shuts and another big door opens, and this is a big, big door. And Sacramento deserves it. We're a major league city in every way. And this is a big, big deal, big boost, and the start of what I consider to be a year, 2019, of breakthroughs on economic development, on homelessness, on investing in youth and in neighborhoods. And it's only less than a month into the new year. It's a great way to start it. We want to be a great city. We connect all that excitement and growth to the neighborhoods and to the young people and those who have been traditionally left out. That's greatness. And we are equally focused on the neighborhoods. In fact, next month, I give my State of the City address, which is traditionally a downtown venue. I'm going to be giving it at the Meadowview Community Center because I think that's not only the right signal. I want to talk about the neighborhoods and youth and tying all of these key pieces together, because we want not just a very good city, we want to be the great city that we are.
One last question, Mayor Steinberg. Can you tell me about the city's commitment to the stadium and entertainment district?
Well, I was very clear today in my speech that the city is not going to provide direct public subsidy, as we did with the downtown sports entertainment facility, the Golden One Center. And by the way, I supported that, and that was appropriate. But in this instance, the stadium is going to be privately financed. Mr. Burkle has bought the team with private financing. We are going to partner with the ownership and the Kellys to expedite and elevate the development of the rail yards. I will stand behind, as I said this morning, the establishment of an infrastructure finance district so that some of the revenues that are generated from all this new development goes back into the infrastructure. We are willing to negotiate pulling back the sign revenue, for example, from electric signage, back into the ownership and the project. We may be willing to donate some land that can double both as an MLS training facility, but also to expand our youth soccer fields. We're willing to waive some fees, but we're not writing a check. We're not contributing resources from our general fund. but we want to be partners in the right way. And I think the public will strongly, I hope the public will strongly support the idea of the city helping to participate in the broader economic development objectives with a private finance strategy for the team and the stadium.
Is this finally, then, the development for the rail yards that people have been waiting eons for? However you want to measure an eon,
well,
it's been a long wait, a long promise.
I think it is a big, big step. But, you know, there's a lot more to go. But, you know, success begets success. And I did tell this story this morning in my speech of how in 1993, as a very young council member, I went over to the rail yards and met with their attorney and saw this great three-dimensional model. And they said, we're going to start development within a year. And, of course, went through my tenure as a council member, assembly member, senator. I talked about how Governor Schwarzenegger used to tease me all the time in our budget negotiations about how, you know, you say, Steiny, when are you going to do something about those rail yards? And, of course, not much happened. The Kellys were the right developer. They hung in there. It's not only Kaiser, it's this $450 million courthouse that we helped push through the state budget. It's now going to be Major League Soccer. It's going to be housing. It's going to be an entertainment district. And by the way, affordable housing as well. And it's just a huge boost. And so no longer are we talking about three-dimensional models. We're actually talking about vision turning into reality. And I couldn't be more excited on behalf of the people of Sacramento.
Comments from Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg in a conversation we recorded yesterday, and he was referencing the State of the City breakfast where he made the announcement about the Ron Burkle investment and the expansion of the rail yard development with the addition of Kaiser. Nick Miller from Cap Radio is in the studio with me. So just a P.S. to where does the Ron Burkle effort go from here? And by the way, this has been a really front and center led effort by the mayor. This isn't as if council members have the same expertise. He has, again, taken this as a very personal commitment of his own time and effort for the city.
Yeah, front and center and very behind the scenes, because during the past year, we were all thinking Sacramento's MLS effort is in the death rattle phase. Like, this isn't working out. This isn't going to happen. Yet in March, Ron Burkle was here. He went to a Kings game with then owner Kevin Nagel. Reportedly, he toured the rail yards. He's been in communications with the commissioner of Major League Soccer, Ron Garber. My theory here is that billionaires don't just jump in and make a big splash and say, I'm going to purchase the team and purchase the land and go for it, unless they have some inclination or maybe even an assurance that it might work out. Because I have a sense, you know, people like Vivek Ranadive, Ron Burkle, these billionaires, these uber wealthy individuals, they don't want to lose, right? They don't want to go into a process only to be told that you don't get your team. That's why would they jump into that?
Pause right there. Then what about Kevin Nagel? What about his experience in this effort?
Well, you know, he took the reins from Warren. He's not the billionaire that Major League Soccer wanted. You know, Major League Soccer told the city and told the Sacramento Republic that we need a billionaire, quote, whale to be the lead investor on this team. And sorry, Mr. Nagel, you're only worth hundreds of millions of dollars, not billions. So unfortunately, that's sort of the scenario that's at play. And you know, the mayor was very gracious yesterday to Nagel and thanked him for all his efforts for really driving this process and courting a new investor. But yeah, that's sort of my hunch. But it's pretty fascinating development. I mean, yesterday we went from not knowing what's going to happen in the rail yards, knowing that there's going to be probably a Kaiser project, to Kaiser's officially purchased the land. They're going to be building a $1 billion hospital medical center. And now Ron Burkle has purchased the proposed stadium site for the Sac Republic soccer team and an additional 14 acres near the stadium east of 7th Street, where he's going to build an entertainment district. And so this is a pretty remarkable development in the past 48 hours.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. In terms of talking behind the scenes, is Kevin Johnson a player in all this behind the scenes?
Yes. Yes, based on reporting that I've done and conversations that I've seen in public forums like Twitter and stuff by people who know, he's involved in bringing Ron Burkle into the fold.
And we should say he's the former Sacramento mayor who involved Ron Burkle initially in the effort to buy the team from the Maloofs to keep the Sacramento Kings here.
Correct. Yeah. When there was the threat of them leaving to Seattle, he was the one who brought Burkle on board. And Burkle had to leave, of course, because the NBA perceived it as a conflict. Yeah, he's involved. I mean, Kevin Johnson, the former mayor, attended the meeting in New York where they made that pitch to Major League Soccer. He was part of the contingent that flew to New York City to do that. So he's definitely involved behind the scenes as well. I won't pretend that I know the depth of his involvement, but it's my understanding that he's a player.
All right. I do want to note again something the mayor said, that he's planning his State of the City address at the Meadowview Community Center. So that date will be February 19th, just about a month before the one-year anniversary of the Stephon Clark shooting in the same community.
Yes, and this is really consistent with Mayor Daryl Steinberg's messaging during the past year, especially as it applies to Measure U. You know, we need to return to these underserved and frankly overlooked communities like Meadowview, like South Elk Park, like North Highlands. We need to start investing in jobs and community development in these areas. And so I think him hosting that State of the City at the Pinnell Center, and to give your listeners an idea, like these State of the City addresses, at least under his predecessor, Kevin Johnson, they were at the Memorial Auditorium. There was fanfare, there was bands. It was sort of an electric event, especially when the threat of losing the Kings loomed and thousands of people converged on the memorial. So this is really a different approach to that discussion of the State of the City.
Hmm. Nick Miller is senior editor of news and features at Cap Radio. Thank you for this conversation. There were a lot of big stories to cover, and they're all just at the beginnings right now.
Yeah, it's an exciting year. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Nick. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. California Senator Kamala Harris has reportedly raised $1.5 million online in just the first day of her campaign to be president. The Wall Street Journal was reporting that came from more than 38,000 individual donors. The average contribution was $37. So you might know that Senator Harris is on a campaign to build national name recognition as well. And fact checkers are going to follow her speeches and her interviews with a different level of scrutiny. The National PolitiFact.com and PolitiFact California have already started that process. In the studio with me is Chris Nichols, based here at Cap Radio for the California team. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Beth.
Glad to have you here. And on the phone from Washington is Angie Holin, the National PolitiFact editor. Hi, Angie. Always glad to have you with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Angie, would you start, because already I believe National worked on and has posted a fact check related to Kamala Harris and in the spotlight because of this run for the presidency?
Yes, we noticed chatter on Twitter about her candidacy, and we fact checked one of these Twitter users who was saying that she was not eligible to be president because her parents are immigrants. We rated this pants on fire wrong because she is eligible to run for president. Her parents are immigrants, but she was born in the United States. Now, I should add, we've had something of a history of fact-checking whether candidates are eligible to run for president because of the constitutional requirement that they be natural-born citizens. John McCain was born in the Panama Canal Zone. Ted Cruz was born in Canada. And Barack Obama was born in Hawaii, but had rumors that he was born in Africa. So this is, for us, this is the latest candidate we've had to fact check whether she's eligible. And Senator Harris is eligible to run for president.
It does speak to people getting a sense of who she is, getting to know her background. And Chris, that's where your work came in, even though I think you also contributed to that national fact check as well. But Talk a bit about the work that the California team's doing.
Well, I think a lot of people are still getting to know Kamala Harris. She is, at least on the national level, still relatively new, new to the U.S. Senate. I think people do know her for her tough questioning of some of President Trump's appointees in the Senate. But aside from that, I think there's still a lot that's unknown about her upbringing, her education, her career, her stances on key issues. So we decided to publish a short article yesterday that really just fills in some of those holes, talks about her being born in Oakland in 1964, being the daughter of immigrants, as Angie mentioned, the daughter of an immigrant mother from India, an immigrant father from Jamaica. And really, some of the themes that we noticed when it comes to her upbringing, her education, are that civil rights, diversity, a focus on education, those all seem to be very important. You see that her father, he remains to this day an economics professor emeritus at Stanford. Her mother was a breast cancer researcher. They both traveled quite a bit for their careers. And those do seem to be themes that Harris has focused on in her campaigns, in her work, and seems to be really an important part of her upbringing. So we tried to capture some of that. And then we've also, looked at some of her positions on things like the border wall. I know we have a soundbite when she was on her book tour and she spoke with On The View about Trump's wall and what she thinks about it.
When I travel this country, folks have plenty enough problems that they need their president to focus on,
you know what,
instead of a wall that, by the way, because I was a prosecutor for many years, including the Attorney General of California, I specialize on transnational criminal organizations.
Yeah.
That wall ain't going to stop them.
No.
There's a real warm response to just the style of talking that she's using, kind of that comfort level with the audience. But she is going to emphasize, I think, in most public forums, that prosecutorial role that she's had both at local, state, and on the national level in politics.
Right. Her career is definitely, I mean, every step of the way, it's been in the world of law enforcement as a prosecutor, starting back in the early 1990s as a deputy district attorney in Alameda County, and then joining the San Francisco City Attorney's Office, later being elected district attorney of the city and county of San Francisco, and as I think more people know, then winning a race in 2010, a close race for California Attorney General, re-elected to a second term there, and then successfully running for Senate 2 years ago. So her career definitely, you know, law enforcement is at the core of her career. It's going to be the focus, I think, of a lot of our work, both at PolitiFact California and the national team's work, as to what exactly did she accomplish? Do her statements as she runs for president, do they match up with, you know, the reality of what was done in those different offices? So we will be certainly looking to scrutinize what she says and hold her to account for her record.
There's an interesting small indicator of the awareness that people have of her just in how they pronounce her first name. And Angie, I know nationally or on the state level, Chris, we don't put pronouncers of the candidates' names there, but you will often hear people say Kamala Harris. And then as they get to know
Kamala. Yep.
And then you listen to her say it, and then you understand that she says Kamala Harris, and the corrections are being made. I'm hearing it even this week. Angie, do you ever notice that?
I have to tell you, I try to avoid saying her first name because I feel like I'm not quite certain. But as more time goes on, I'm sure I'll get it down. I have noticed all sorts of different pronunciations. I think this is
on the state level.
Part of the getting to know her process.
When she became attorney general, I was thinking, I have to get this right. And I would think to myself, it's a common name, which would remind me Kamala, and give my first. But you have to listen to her say it to know the way that it is to be said right. Chris, can I wrap you back around quickly to the point about the wall, and that you did a separate but related fact check, and this has to do with drug trafficking and the wall.
Right. Well, the national team has essentially fact-checked this topic plenty of times. They've looked at the issue of drug smuggling. They've looked at the issue of the wall that Harris was talking about in her interview on The View. And PolitiFact has pointed out that most drugs enter the country through legal ports of entry, and that drug trafficking would not necessarily be reduced by a wall. I think that's the point that Harris was making. A number of experts on the topic make this point. A number of federal reports also make this point as well.
So, Angie, I will point people to the PolitiFact.com website for more fact-checking about the wall. But on the point of President Trump, we are 2 years, as of this week, into his presidency. And that's a good checkpoint for looking at promises he made besides the wall and to what degree those have been kept. So can you share a few of those with us?
Yes. Trump has made some progress on his promises he's kept. We tracked just over 100 promises. He's kept 17, and another 11 have been rated compromise. So that means roughly about a quarter he's had either success or partial success. Now, on the other side, he has broken some promises, and other promises he just hasn't been able to get done, and they're stalled. And that's about 45% of his promises that he's really not making progress on.
Well, one that was clearly kept was his promise to nominate from his list of candidates a justice to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia. That was a clear one. Let's go to another that wasn't so clear. Your pick.
Okay, I'll look at his promise to cut taxes for everyone. One of his biggest successes was a major tax bill. It cut corporate taxes. It reduced tax rates. But when we looked into the details of it, it didn't cut taxes for everyone. So we rated it compromise. And one of the issues with this tax bill is that the tax cuts for regular people, for individuals, sunset. So he got a lot, but he didn't quite get everything he promised. That one we rated compromise.
Okay, choose a broken promise. Let's look at one of those examples.
Well, this one is somewhat related to his tax bill. One of his promises was balance the federal budget fairly quickly. And that rates promise broken. Trump came in talking about wanting to balance the budget, reduce the deficit, have spending discipline, but that's largely been abandoned now that he's in office. The tax cut bill did not have offsets to prevent it from increasing the deficit. The deficit is how the government spends more money than it takes in every year. And Trump's legislation has caused the deficit to grow. So for all the talk we heard of fiscal discipline from Trump's party during the Obama administration, they don't seem to be walking the walk now that they hold power.
Let me try one more question, Angie. We'll see if the phone line holds. Do you have some context for this 25% success rate in terms of promises kept for this president?
Yes, the promises that Trump has been able to keep are mostly the ones he's been able to do with executive action. So he came in, he signed some executive orders, particularly on immigration. So when he acts by himself, he has success. He doesn't seem to have used his first 2 years of Republican majorities to get a whole lot of legislation passed. That would be in contrast to President Barack Obama, who got a number of big laws passed when he held Democratic majorities. Now, again, like Obama, Trump has the opposition to work with in Congress. The Democrats control the House of Representatives, so he's going to have a harder time getting legislation through.
All right, Angie, I'm going to let you go while the sound is still good. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program, and I know that will happen more between now and Election Day 2020. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was National PolitiFact editor Angie Holin. We'll post a link to PolitiFact.com. You can find much more to fill your appetite for political fact-checking. In the studio still with me is Chris Nichols. And on the subject of keeping campaign promises, let's go to one of your new projects, which is the Newsom Meter.
That's right. We published and launched our Newsom Meter this month, tracking 12 of Gavin Newsom's campaign promises. He, of course, made bold promises over the last few years on housing, healthcare, education, homelessness. And we have started to publish some updates as he has made some proposals on some of these topics.
I think the updates are important because some people might say we're not even into the first month of his governorship at this point. So how can we know even in the relatively near future if a promise is or has been kept?
Well, his first week in office, with the release of his budget, he did at least make proposals. And with our project, if a candidate or in this case an executive is at least making proposals, we will typically look at those, see if they actually are evidence of some kind of concrete action or proposal towards that promise. We did rate a couple in the works. Certainly, it's too early to say whether these promises will be kept, just like President Trump, who has to rely on Congress to take action, to actually see some of his promises get achieved. Governor Newsom will rely on the legislature to take action to see if his goals get met. So one that we focused on was Newsom's promise to create universal health care in California. His budget does take some steps towards that. It proposes expanding Medi-Cal coverage for young undocumented adults in California. It also talks about expanding subsidies through Covered California to make healthcare more affordable. And we spoke with Gerald Kaminsky, director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, and he weighed in on Newsom's early progress.
I think that the governor has made some pretty significant progress in terms of proposals to reduce the number of uninsured in California and to strengthen the Affordable Care Act. So I'm satisfied that he's moving things forward. He is not going to achieve health care for all with the proposals that he has proposed so far this week. But he's also said that, you know, that is a continuing goal. And I think what he's done is made a down payment on some significant steps.
So on the universal health care promise in California, that's an in the works. And let's touch one more briefly, and that is the promise to create free community college for Californians.
That's right. That was also a top promise by Newsom. California already offers 1 year of free community college to students who are eligible. Newsom proposed adding $40 million in the next fiscal year to extend that, to extend the program to 2 free years. Again, that rated in the works. We published an article about this. There are quite a few criteria and eligibility requirements. You have to be a first-time full-time student taking 12 or more semester units to be considered full-time. So it's a limited number of students that would be able to see free community college. We will see if that expands. We'll see how much it really is free community college in California when we get further into his term.
All right. That is the Newsom Meter to watch at PolitiFactCalifornia.com. Thank you, Chris. And
thank
you to your team and the work that's happening in tandem right now with PolitiFact.com.
Thank you very much.
That is Chris Nichols. And you can find more at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Shelley Blanton Stroud started writing fiction more than 10 years ago after her husband almost died in a scuba diving accident. That's absolutely a true story, and she has become quite disciplined since about her writing. She is also an English lecturer and professor, most often at Sacramento State, and work from a draft of her second novel is going to be featured this Friday at Stories on Stage Sacramento, which is kicking off its 10th season. Shelley's in the studio. Welcome. So glad to have you here on Insight.
So happy to be here, Beth.
I think we should begin with that story about your husband's near-death experience and how that translated into writing fiction.
Well, yes. It was about 12 years ago, and my husband and my two sons were in the Monterey Peninsula on a scuba diving trip. And I was just about ready to leave the house when the phone rang, and I picked it up. On the screen, it said, Monterey Ambulance. And my first thought was, which one is it? And when I answered the phone, my son Will's voice came on, and he said, everything's okay. We're going to the hospital. Dad's had heart failure. And of course, we then went through the days that you go through that everybody's so familiar with when something like that happens. He was fine, and he is fine. But that was sort of when and why I made the decision to start writing. Because after a moment like that, many people feel, as I did, that if there's something I want to do, I just better do it now. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started to write.
In the bit of your work that I've read, you do carry that voice of something big can happen. There can be a dramatic moment, and it can change everything. And do you feel that internalized because of that accident, or is that a part of your personality?
There have been incidents in my own life that were big in that way and transformative. So, yes, I believe it personally. But, well, for instance, the short work that has just recently been anthologized by Baobab Press is the beginning of my novel that'll be coming out next year. And it's based on a family story of a terrible experience that my father had as a child. And so there are times when I've heard my father say, what you need to know about me was what happened to me that day. And I think maybe I inherited that, or at least learned it in family life, that there are big emotional family events that change your trajectory.
Let's move immediately to the story that's going to be featured this Friday then, because the title of it is Attention Must Be Paid. But you set it up almost the same way that you just described your dad. What's important to know about this tennis star is that she is the reigning, defending tennis star. And this is a very athletic, dramatic, fast read, short story. And it was one that actually didn't make the cut into a novel?
That's right. I wrote a novel, and I had to finish 300 pages of it to know what the novel was. And by reading through it and getting feedback from excellent readers, it became clear to me that just a portion of it was really the heart of the novel. So that's kind of like carving up a cadaver and saying, oh my gosh, now I've got to get rid of this arm and this leg and this scalp. Sorry to be so crude, but that's the way it almost feels. And yet I'm in love with so many of the characters and so many of the scenes that I didn't want to make them go away forever. And so right now those pieces are getting converted into stories that might live on their own, even if they don't live in the novel itself.
Let's talk about Bella Steinhardt then. I think I should just have you read the first paragraph of this short story. We'll spend a little time there. And again, Stories on Stage at the Clara Auditorium this Friday. Shelley Blanton Stroud is one of the featured writers. And this is a short bit from her story, Attention Must Be Paid.
If you want to know how Bella Steinhardt, maybe the greatest female tennis player ever, according to Sports Illustrated, and the most slavically beautiful, according to Rolling Stone, fell so hard from the peak, how she fought to climb back, and how her fight ruined everybody around her. If you want to know the true story, not just what you've seen on TMZ or 30 for 30 or read in the unauthorized biographies Love, Fault, Break, or Big Time Loser, then you have to begin with what happened last year on the second Saturday of July, the day Bella tempted fate and returned to Wimbledon as defending champion, the day she broke the internet.
And if you think we're going into a story about a tennis match, we're not. We're going to learn next about Rufus the Hawk, who is the celebrity predator at the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club. This story is actually about the fidgety things that people do when they prepare to enter into something adrenaline-forced and focused.
Yes, it's funny because, I mean, a lot of my friends find it very humorous that I'm writing about tennis. I am not a tennis player. I am not an athlete of any kind.
Are you a tennis watcher?
Scarcely that.
Wow.
I've read so many books about tennis. But the reason for it lies underneath. I was really entertained that you were talking about Ron Burkle this morning, because when my sons were young was when the Kings first became very interesting to our family. So everybody was talking about the Kings all the time. And I couldn't participate in those conversations in a normal sports lover's way. So to me, the way it became interesting was to think of them as characters. And one of the most interesting things to me were the ritualistic behaviors I saw on the court, to see Mike Bibby trimming his fingernails to the quick at every timeout, to see Doug Christie's bizarre series of behaviors before he would shoot a free throw. It really captivated me. And so then I began to wonder, what is that all about? Why do people at the peak of their prowess, who have such great talent and skill and really believe in themselves and their own power, why are they then ritualistic, superstitious? Why do they believe fate has some power over them? It also connected to my learning about the former star and famous person Chris Webber's famous timeout call, that something significant can happen in the life of a player that seems to define them for the rest of their life. And so that's what led me to look at these tics and superstitions and rituals and fate.
Were you able to stop the sports talk, the X's and O's at times, with these conversations and observances about the quirks that athletes had or Kings players had?
I find it hard to find a partner in these conversations because when my family talks about sports, they do talk about X's and O's and boxing out and this and that and the other thing. And I try to learn a little bit about that. And certainly I have learned a lot about tennis I never thought I would. But it could never be the heart of the book for me, because really the thing I love about sport is the way it reveals human nature and story arcs in a very concrete way. I love ideas, and I believe that ideas are revealed best through concrete action and story. And so that's what story is to me. Hmm. The biggest trouble I'm having right now is writing the tennis scenes. I'm sure that won't surprise you.
This story is part of a story anthology titled This Side of the Divide, Stories of the American West.
May I correct you there? I'm sorry. This is not the story that's in that anthology.
Okay. There is a different story. You have two different novels and an anthology.
I have two different novels, one that's coming out next year, one that I'm working on now, and in the anthology is the first chapter of the novel coming out next year.
Great. I also want to mention this Friday, Tom Barbash and his best-selling new novel, The Dakota Winters, will be featured as well. And I have been in communication for so long with Tom to get him to have a conversation about his book on the show, so that will happen in the future.
Yes, it's a fantastic novel.
Let's say something about Stories on Stage Sacramento, because the 10th season is a great time to jump in. Not everybody understands what happens with an author and actors in this setting.
Well, the way that they run it is that Sue Statz and before her Valerie Fioravanti choose an established, really kind of famous writer like Tom Barbash. And they couple that writer with a local writer and generally try to sort of fit their stories together. And what happens is they then cast actors to read those stories. And it's just an incredible treat. There are enough people there to let you know it's got a buzz. And yet there in the Clara Auditorium, it is intimate and warm and very literary in a local way. It's a fantastic series. So to achieve this 10th year is really something.
What are you working on next? What's dancing around in your mind to explore?
Well, the main thing is that I'm taking those 300 pages and putting them in a drawer and starting over again to renew it, to let it not be about every character in my mind, but to let it focus on Bella, the tennis player.
And the quirky thing that happens that changes everything at this tennis match is a rubber band in her hair breaking. It sets it all in motion. So it is a pleasure. Will you please come back as your work unfolds and unwraps? But enjoy this Friday night with everyone.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Shelley Blanton Stroud and her novel Harvest of Invention will be in This Side of the Divide, Stories of the American West. That's an excerpt of it. We'll post a link so that you can walk your way through Shelley's work and her history. That is Shelley Blanton Stroud. She will be at Stories on Stage Sacramento this Friday at the Clara Auditorium. We'll post a link to that event and a link to find out more about her work. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Cody Drabble and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today is Anthony Van Hook. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.